Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Nicholas Niarchos, a journalist whose work focuses on energy, war, and migration. And tonight we're talking about his new book, The Elements of Power, a story of war, technology, and the dirtiest supply chain on Earth. Nick, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
This book is the culmination of many years' worth of on-the-ground research and reporting. When did you first start getting interested in this subject, and when did you first visit or learn about what's going on in the Congo?
So I started working on this subject back in 2019, and I was really interested to go to the DRC specifically because of a corruption case involving Dan Gertler. He's an Israeli fixer who has gotten very, very rich off flipping copper and cobalt mines, and he has very, very close connections to the former president. And then when I got there, I realized that the story was much, much bigger than Gertler. I mean, it was to do with child labor. It was to do with, human rights. It was to do with an intense geopolitical conflict, which at that point was just starting to heat up between the U.S. and China. That has only increased over the years. And, as I saw that sort of manifesting through the first Trump, the second Biden, the Biden administration, and now the second Trump administration, I realized that this is really a story that needs to be told.
It really is. I mean, this is one of those books that changed me in some way. And you can't stop talking to people about the book. Basically, if you use an iPhone, you drive an electric vehicle or any other kind of thing that uses lithium-ion batteries, this is a story about a supply chain that most people don't want to think about.
Well, I mean, I think that's very much the case, and it's been designed to insulate companies at the end of the supply chain from criticism. I mean, it's so opaque that you have a situation in which people really don't understand where their minerals come from, where their batteries are being made, and how they get into their pockets.
And I think there's a vested interest that they don't want to know. I think people don't want to hear this story. Now, the raw materials we're talking about, let's go over what they are.
Yeah, so the primary raw material I talk about in the book is cobalt, which is used in many, many lithium-ion batteries. There are a lot of people who will say, oh, well, this book's not relevant because there are lithium-ion batteries now that have been created without cobalt. And I go into those materials later in the book.
Right.
That's things like phosphates, iron, so on. But actually, cobalt is still used in the overwhelming majority of cell phones and small devices, things like laptops and so on like that. And it is used in many, many electric car batteries as well. Then I look at copper, I look at lithium, I look at nickel, especially in Indonesia. And these are all components of batteries or of, copper is used very much, for electrical wiring and things like that. And it's very much raw material that is needed for the transition to a greener economy if the supply chain was sorted out. Another material that I talk about.
There are many threads in this book. There's a whole story about the invention of an electric car, which goes back to the 1800s. There's the whole history of the Congo, which I want to touch on because that's a dramatic history. But there's just all these stories. But they all wrap up in basically cleaner power at home, pollution and suffering elsewhere. And that's sort of the trade-off we're doing so far. And it's not that you support the oil economy at all. You're just saying that what we've set up so far has really tragic results down the line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the problems with the way that people look at this is it's a sort of binary. You know, oil good, electric cars bad, or oil bad, electric cars good. And my point is really not this. It's basically that electric cars, you know, could be wonderful for the environment, and that is just. But the question is, how are they made? And at the moment, they're not made particularly cleanly. You know, we know how to mine in a cleaner way. We know how to have a supply chain that doesn't involve, you know, factories that are very polluting,
right,
or sending things through areas of geopolitical risk, and we're not doing that. And that's the point of the book. The point of the book is that the supply chain is very dirty, not that the technology itself is inherently bad.
Right. Right. Let's spend a moment talking about the Republic of Congo. It's got a hugely complicated and very tragic history going all the way back to the 1800s, to the when it was known as the Belgian Congo. Can we just talk about the Congo as a political entity for a moment?
Yes. So the Democratic Republic of the Congo is the former Belgian Congo. In 1885, it was declared a sort of piece of private property called the Congo Free State, which was then sort of ruthlessly exploited by King Leopold II, who essentially treated it as a profit center for Belgium. And Leopold was so brutal and ruthless that his own parliament, and he was extracting rubber, he was extracting ivory. You know, they would do things like cut the hands off villagers if they didn't.
Well, there's a photograph in your book that's absolutely heartbreaking of a father looking at the hand and the foot of his daughter that's been cut off. I mean, that's one of the most shocking photographs I've seen lately.
It's absolutely awful. And that, you know, that story, that violence, that brutality sort of reverberated, not just through media and the invention of photography basically allowed that photo. That photo was one of the most important factors in getting the Belgian parliament to say, look, finito. This is not good. What's happening here? But what replaced Leopold was a colonial system, which was, you know, if not as brutal, certainly very much the same. You know, just as extractive. And that was as the world was electrifying, and you know, you had a situation in which copper became very important, and you know, Congo was at that point the world's largest copper producer. And then you had just, you know, the continuation of this sort of brutality that continued throughout colonialism until independence in 1960. After independence, what happened is that we got to a point of where there were elections, and the U.S. was unhappy with a candidate who won, Patrice Lumumba,
right,
and they did everything in their power to unseat him, and obviously Belgium as well was very much in the mix. Lumumba was killed by an army officer named Mobutu Sese Seko. And Mobutu became the dictator of Congo, and this is a sort of potted history. I'm sorry for people who already know this.
Yeah.
But Mobutu basically continued this legacy of extraction. When Mobutu gets kicked out of power in 1997 by first Laurent Désiré Kabila, and then Joseph Kabila, his son takes power. They continue to this sort of legacy of extraction, and it's very, very much you can sort of trace, which I do in the book, these kind of Belgian structures and the way that things are structured at a sort of corporate level, to the brutality of Leopold and to some of these companies that were set up to run the colony right at the beginning.
And there's complications with warfare going on between people surrounding them too. It's a very complicated, and you do a great job of laying it out. The basic is that there's most of the people in the Congo are just exploited, whether it's by their own government or by other governments coming in. It's an absolutely brutal story. The mines that we're talking about, they're in the southern part of the country. Congo is a large country. It's in the southern part of the country, right, that mostly you're talking about?
Yeah, Congo is a huge country. I mean, the kind of classic thing that people say is it's the size of Western Europe. These are mines mainly in the southern part of the country. But actually, I'm talking about a very specific set of mines, which are really mostly around a town called Kolwezi. So when you're talking about the sort of Cobalt Revolution, you're talking about like one province, and not even one province, like half of one province, basically.
And these are some of the poorest people in the world. And when you write about the conditions in the area, both for the people working in the mines, but also around where there's a huge increase in birth defects and all sorts of other stuff going on, it's a horrific story.
It's a horrific story. It's you have a situation which is essentially that these people who are some of the poorest in the world are made poorer and poorer, and then they're exposed to incredibly harmful toxic effects. I mean, this is a story, however, that we see in what is termed sacrifice zones. These are areas that basically industry has deemed it okay to sacrifice all around the world, and this is a unfortunately, this kind of thing happens in places around the world. The thing about Congo is it's just so extreme. I mean, you see these people who are really, really have absolutely nothing. I mean, they're living in kind of these ragged tent cities, or if they do have places in town, they do have kind of bricks and mortar places. They're very, very rudimentary. And they're just there's just this sort of almost conspiracy of industry and power, political power, to sort of keep them down.
Well, as you write, the corporations took full advantage of the situation there, advantage of the conditions, and they don't care. I mean, there are thousands of children who work in these mines.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to make the distinction between artisanal mining, which is sort of hand mining, this is what an industry term, and then industrial mining. Industrial mining is mining that would happens, in a way that basically exists all over the world. And artisanal mining is quite specific to the DRC. Although it mimics kind of coal mining in the 1950s, say, or mining for Burmese rubies or something like that. So it's very, very dangerous circumstances. People go down these very deep holes. They are often liable to collapse. Pregnant women are sent down. Are often there washing the minerals when they're taken out of these holes. We have situations in which, there is a great deal of child labor. I mean, nobody really knows how much child labor, and I don't think that number is particularly stable. So I think that trying to quantify it is a very, very, very difficult task. You have a situation in which people are, again, exploited. There's an argument to say that artisanal mining should not be immediately abolished as a practice. I mean, there are ways of doing artisanal mining safely, you know, with safety equipment and reinforced mine structures and so on. And I think that argument does hold water, because many, many people are employed through artisanal mining around the province. But the fact is that the safety net, the safety guards, which is, you know, there's supposed to be a sort of licensing system and so on, in the, you know, around artisanal mining, and that kind of the guardrails that are supposed to exist there just don't really exist because of corruption and poverty and so on. So you have a situation in which people are very much, you know, left to their own devices, and this is the point that exploitation of all kinds of underprivileged and you know, very young people happens.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Nicholas Niarchos, a journalist whose work focuses on energy, war, and migration. And tonight we're talking about his new book. I strongly recommend it. The Elements of Power, a story of war, technology, and the dirtiest supply chain on Earth. Nick, as I mentioned before, there are several really interesting stories in your book. One of them is about the decline of mining in the United States. Can we just talk about that for a minute? I mean, we sort of passed aside mining because it's so dirty.
Yeah, I mean, I think that mining in the U.S. Has gotten a bad rap. And I think that there are companies, I mean, I focus on one mine in Idaho, Bunker Hill.
Right.
Where people are trying to do it in an environmentally sound way with remediation and so on and so forth. But the problem was that mining in the U.S. became this kind of clash between industry interests and the federal government. Unfortunately, what happened, I guess, in the period of, you know, globalization, 90s, is that people realized that it could be done cheaper, and cheaper means much less safely, in other parts of the world. The U.S. has incredible reserves of things like rare earths and other strategic metals, but it is incredibly expensive to mine in the U.S. because of environmental legislation and restrictions that are basically necessary. Now, it remains to be seen whether this mining boom, which everybody has prophesied under both the last administration and now this administration, will actually happen. But the world, you know, the world and U.S. industry needs more critical metals. So chances are that there will be more critical metals mines in the U.S.
We're going to go through a couple of subjects really quickly because we're going to run out of time. There's a chapter you have about whether we could make a better battery that wouldn't use metals that have to be mined exploitively. And it's sort of a sad story. First of all, it seems like the Chinese or the Japanese are the countries that are working most on this, on improving battery technology. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that the Chinese at this point are at the forefront of battery research. I mean, there's very good U.S. research happening at Argonne National Lab. The Japanese are working on very specific things around battery storage, but the Chinese keep kind of at this point trumping research that's happening in this country and elsewhere.
Well, you say, as you write, there's 36 Chinese companies just working on other alternative batteries. And there are other ideas like solid-state batteries, quasi-solid-state batteries like sodium and sulfur. You know, would a sodium ion cell, what that would be like. But it seems like the Chinese are investing the most money in it, and other countries, especially the United States, are falling behind on this.
Absolutely. I mean, that 36 number, by the way, I think that 36 companies is working on sodium ion batteries.
Right.
I mean, that number is that number has probably blossomed and bloomed since I wrote the book. So that was 36 at a very specific point of time, which I think was last year or late the year before. I would say that sodium ion batteries are it's an important technology. It's something that might be able to power small electric vehicles, probably not our devices because they'd have to be too big to go into cell phones and laptops, and they're not as powerful as the lithium cobalt oxide batteries that are currently in our phones and laptops. Yes, sorry.
I just wanted to mention another before we run out of time. There's a chapter called "Will There Ever Be an African Electric Car?" And I find that really sad because there are people working on that. Was it in Uganda?
In Uganda, yes.
And what's happening there? Are they succeeding?
Well, they're making electric cars, which are basically Chinese kits. So billed as African electric cars, but they are essentially created in Shenzhen and then sent over and assembled in Africa. Now, I mean, no one else is doing that, so that's something. But it of course is quite sad. I mean, it shows China's hold over the continent, and it shows how that industry has been completely centralized in China.
I know, and I think that's one of the big takeaways, besides the obvious ones about the mines. China has tremendous influence in countries in Africa. And I don't think the average American even understands that or why it's important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Trump administration is trying to reverse it, but in ways that are just completely strange. I mean, they have jumped into bed with some very, very strange bedfellows in Africa. They've also done some good things. You know, they've engaged vigorously with the DRC in Rwanda and tried to get them to sign a peace deal. But I think what they don't understand is that China's engagement in Africa is very, very deep-seated, and it comes from years and years of trade deals, industry negotiations, and so on. And they thought that they could, you know, stop the war in Congo between Congo and Rwanda by signing a peace deal at the White House, and then everybody would magically go back to their barracks, and there would be peace forevermore. Of course, that peace deal was broken, you know, basically the moment it was signed, and we have a situation in which the U.S. is kind of saying, well, nobody's playing fair kind of thing. And they've sanctioned the Rwandan government, which has long aggressed part of the eastern DRC. And the Chinese have just sort of sat back and kind of watched. You know, their policies have been kind of amoral. They haven't really picked a winner. They've just said, look, we'll work with anybody.
Right, right.
And that might turn out to be the most successful strategy in these kinds of conflicts, because the U.S. is getting involved politically and doesn't seem to have that deep investment, these deep-rooted ties to the country and to their economy.
We only have a few minutes left, but the book ends with you standing in a mass grave in the Republic of Congo. That was a dramatic way to end the book.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that symbolized, how people had been treated in Congo. I mean, it was, you know, these people had been dumped in the ground. They've been mining the minerals that go into our cell phones and so on. And then, you know, the mine collapsed, and they were just sort of dumped. And, you know, I think the local government didn't have money for enough coffins, so they just sort of put a whole bunch of bodies into a hole in the ground and said, okay, we're done with it.
Well, I have to mention before we go that there's a chapter where you are, quote unquote, detained for some time in the Congo. which is going to be one of the most frightening things I've ever read. It's like somehow you kept a little journal of it in different and the hour by hour, day by day situation of you incarcerated under horrible conditions. And that just sort of came out of nowhere. You have to have been obviously worried about your life.
Yeah, there were some moments where I was worried.
No, there were some moments, Nick.
There were some moments. But it was also carried out, I have to say, at this sort of pitch of high hilarity. And it was weird because everybody was making jokes with me.
Right. That's just made it more horrible to me as the reader. It seems surreal.
It was really weird. It was really weird. I mean, the strain, the thing about it wasn't just terror all the time. I just had to, like, take a step back and just look at the strangeness of everything that was happening. And it was just like, just imagine being held by a bunch of the least intelligent people that you've ever met and trying to explain to them what you were doing and then trying to say you were doing something else. And they were saying, you're a spy. And I was like, no, I'm a journalist. And they just didn't understand what journalism was, basically, which obviously speaks, you know, volumes about that country and its attitude to the free press. I think that was...
Well, you can laugh about it now, but I could tell, and from reading it, I would be scared shitless.
Of course, it was terrifying. I'm just saying it had this surreal...
It did have a weird, surreal air about it, especially the things they were saying to you, too. It was just odd. That's one reason to pick up a... You should just read the whole book. My guest tonight has been Nicholas Niarchos, a journalist whose work focuses on energy, war, and migration, and he's put that to good use in writing the book The Elements of Power, a story of war technology and the dirtiest supply chain on Earth. Nick, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.